Chapter 4 1 It had been a very bad winter in the mountains. Snow slides had early blocked the passes into the high meadow. Chrissy sat quietly and forlornly in front of the council in the courthouse. The wind whined and moaned through the gaps in the walls, and the fire that had been built in the center of the room sent harried palls of smoke into the faces of the council. Parson Staffer lay very ill in a nearby hut. The winter had sapped what little vitality he had, and his place was taken by the older Jimson man they were now calling Parson. Jimson was flanked by an elder named Clay and by Brown Limper Staffer, who seemed to be acting as a council member, even though he was far too young and club-footed. He had begun to sit in for Parson Staffer when he became ill and had just stayed on, grown into a council member now. The three men sat on an old bench. Chrissy, across the fire from them, was not paying much attention. She had had a horrible nightmare 2 nights ago, a nightmare that had yanked her, sweating, out of sleep and left her trembling ever since. She had dreamed that Johnny had been consumed in fire. He had been calling her name, and it still sounded in her ears. "It's just plain foolishness," Parson Jimson was saying to her. "There are three young men who want to marry you, and you have no right whatever to refuse them. The village population is dwindling in size. Only 30 have survived the winter. This is not a time to be thinking only of yourself." Chrissy numbly realized he was talking to her. She made an effort to gather the words in, something about population. Two babies had been born that winter, and two babies had died. The young men had not driven many cattle up from the plains before the pass closed, and the village was half-starved. If Johnny had been here...
"When spring comes," said Chrissy, "I'm going down on the plains to find Johnny."
This was no shock to the council. They had heard her say it several times since Johnny left. Brown Limper looked through the smoke at her. He had a faint sneer on his lips. The council tolerated him because he didn't ever say much, and because he brought them water and food when meetings were too long. But he couldn't resist.
"We all know Johnny must be dead. The monsters must have got him."
Jimson and Clay frowned at him. He had been the one who brought their attention to the fact that Chrissy refused to marry any of the young men. Clay wondered whether Brown Limper didn't have a personal stake in this. Chrissy rallied from her misery.
"His horses didn't come home."
"Maybe the monsters got them, too," said Brown Limper.
"Johnny did not believe there were any monsters," said Chrissy. "He went to find the great village of the legend."
"Oh, there are monsters, all right," said Jimson. "It is blasphemy to doubt the legends."
"Then," said Chrissy, "why don't they come here?"
"The mountains are holy," said Jimson.
"The snow," said Brown Limper, "closed the passes before the horses could come home. That is, if the monsters didn't get them, too."
The older man looked at him, frowning him to silence.
"Chrissy," said Parson Jimson, "you are to put aside this foolishness and permit the young men to court you. It is quite obvious that Johnny Goodboy Tyler is gone."
"When the year has gone by," said Chrissy, "I shall go down to the plains."
"Chrissy," said Clay, "this is simply a suicidal idea."
Chrissy looked into the fire. Johnny's scream echoed in her ears from the nightmare. It was completely true what they said. She did not want to live if Johnny was dead. And then the sound of the scream died away, and she seemed to hear him whisper her name. She looked up with a trace of defiance.
"He is not dead," said Chrissy.
The three council members looked at each other. They had not prevailed. They would try again some other day. They ignored her and fell to discussing the fact that Parson Staffer wanted a funeral when he died. There wouldn't be much in the way of food, and there were problems of digging in the frozen ground. Of course, he was entitled to a funeral, for he had been parson and maybe even mayor for many years. But there were problems. Chrissy realized she was dismissed, and she got up, eyes red with more than smoke, and walked to the courthouse door.
She wrapped the bear skin more tightly about her and looked up at the wintry sky. When the constellation was in that same place in spring, she would go. The wind was cutting keen, and she pulled the bear skin even tighter. Johnny had given her the bear skin, and she fingered it. She would get busy and make him some new buckskin clothes. She would prepare packs. She would not let them eat the last two horses. When the time came, she would be all ready to go, and she would go. A blast of wind from High Peak chilled her, mocked her. Nevertheless, when the time came, she would go. 2. Turl was in a furious burst of activity. He hardly slept. He left the Kerbango alone. The doom of years of exile on this cursed planet haunted him. Each time he slowed his pace, he collided with the horrible thought, and it jabbed him into even greater efforts. Leverage, leverage. He conceived himself to be a pauper in leverage. He had a few things on employees here and there, but they were minor things. Peccadillos with some of the cyclo-female clerks. Drunkenness on the job leading to breakage. Tapes of mutterings about foremen. Personal letters smuggled into the teleportation of ore, but nothing big. This was not the kind of thing personal fortunes were easily built from. Yet here were thousands of cyclos, and his experience as a security officer told him the odds in favor of finding blackmail material were large. The company did not hire angels. It hired miners and mining administrators, and it hired them tough. In some cases, particularly on a planet like this, no favored spot, the company even winked at taking on ex-criminals. It was a criticism of himself, no less, that he could not get more blackmail than he had. This Numph. Now, there was one. He had potential leverage on Numph, but Turl did not know what it was. He knew it had something to do with the nephew Knipe in home office accounting. But Turl could not dig out what it really was, and so he dared not push it. The risk lay in pretending to be wise to it, and then, by some slip, revealing he didn't have the data. The leverage would go up in smoke, for Numph would know Turl had nothing, so he had to use it so sparingly that it was almost no use at all. Last. As the days and weeks of winter went on, a new factor arose. His requests for information from the home planet were not being answered. Only that one scrap about Knipe. That was all. It was a trifle frightening. No answers. He could send green flash urgents until he wore out his pen, and there wasn't even an acknowledgement. He had even become sly and reported the discovery of a non-existent hoard of arms. Actually, it was just a couple of muzzle-loading bronze cannons some workmen had dug up in a mine site on the overseas continent. But Turl had worded the report in such a way that it was alarming, although it could be retracted with no damage to himself. A routine, essential report. And no acknowledgement had come back. None. He had investigated furiously to see whether other departmental reports got like treatment. They didn't. He had considered the possibility that Numph was removing reports from the teleportation box. Numph wasn't. Home Office knew he existed, that was for sure. They had confirmed the additional 10-year duty stretch, and noted Numph's commendation affirmative, and had added the clause of company optional extension. So they knew he was alive, and there could not possibly be any action being taken against him, or he would have intercepted interrogatories about himself. There had been none. So, without any hope of Home Office cooperation, it was obviously up to Turl to dig himself out. The ancient security maxim was ever present in his mind now. Where a situation is needed but doesn't exist, make one. His pockets bulged with button cameras, and his skill in hiding them was expert. Every picto recorder he could lay his paws on lined the shelves of his office, and he kept his door locked. Just now he was glued to a scope, observing the garage interior. He was waiting for Zzt to go to lunch. In his belt, Turl had the duplicate keys to the garage. Open beside him was the book of company regulations relating to the conduct of personnel, Security Volume 989, and it was open to Article 34A-4, Uniform Code of Penalties. The article said, "Wherein and whereas theft viciously affects profits," and there followed 5 pages of company theft penalties. "And whereas and wherefore company personnel also have rights to their monies, bonuses, and possessions," and there followed 1 page of different aspects of it, "the theft of personal monies from the quarters of employees by employees, when duly evidenced, shall carry the penalty of vaporization." That was the key to Turl's present operation. It didn't say theft went on record. It didn't say a word about when it happened as related to when it was to be punished. The key items were "when duly evidenced" and "vaporization." There was no judicial vaporization chamber on this planet, but that was no barrier. A blast gun could vaporize anyone with great thoroughness. There were 2 other clauses in that book that were important. "All company executives of whatever grade shall uphold these regulations." And, "the enforcement of all such regulations shall be vested in the security officers, their assistants, deputies, and personnel." The earlier one included Numpf. He could not even squeak. The latter one meant Turl, the sole and only security officer, or deputy, or assistant, or personnel on this planet. Turl had spot-watched Zt for a couple of days now, and he knew where he kept his dirty work coats and caps. Ah, Zt was leaving. Turl waited to make sure the transport chief did not come back because he had forgotten something. Good. He was gone. With speed, but not to betray himself or alarm anyone by rushing, if met in the halls, Turl went to the garage. He let himself in with a duplicate key and went directly to the washroom. He took down a dirty work coat and cap. He let himself out and locked the door behind him. For days now, Turl had also watched, with an artfully concealed button camera, the room of the smaller Champco brother. He had found what he wanted. After work, the smaller Champco brother habitually changed from his mine clothes in his room and put on a long coat he affected for dinner and an evening's gambling in the recreation area. More, the smaller Champco brother always put and kept his cash in the cup of an antique drinking horn that hung on the wall of his room. Turl now scanned the mine site patiently. He finally spotted the smaller Champco brother, exiting from the compound, finished with lunch, and boarding the bus to the teleportation transshipment area where he worked.